And now, a message from Nash.
Hey kids, something happened during this episode. I talked too long. I know, it's shocking. Many of you have fainted with surprise. No, but seriously, when we do two-parters, as you've heard in the past, they're either planned or else we realize during an episode and say so. We decide in real time with y'all listening that a story needs the full episode to be told properly. What happened here was one of those situations, or it should have been, but neither of us were paying attention to the time because we were so into the story that you're about to hear. Matter of fact, you'll notice that my lovely co-host was in mostly silent TIFF mode because she was more interested in listening than commenting. Anyway, point is, what I'll do is get TIFF's story ready for the next time. And if it ends up being short, I'll do y'all another story with the same theme to round it out. Don't you worry, we won't shortchange you. Okay, that's all from here. Enjoy the show.
The question of the existence of a soul and where it may go after death has been around for ages, and some claim to have seen and spoken with spirits from beyond the grave. Can we really believe our eyes and ears, or could there be a simpler and earthbound explanation?
You are listening to You Totally Made That Up. We are a bi-weekly history podcast that aims to tell you the craziest, weirdest, most bizarre, out of this world. TIFF, what other adjectives am I missing?
Wild, unbelievable.
Those stories, the kind of stories that make you think someone must have totally made them up. And we have a special place in our hearts for the ones that have paranormal, supernatural, woo-woo type of bends to them. However small, doesn't matter. Even if it's small, we're going to love it. So welcome. And if this is your first time joining us, double welcome. My name is Nash.
And my name is TIFF.
We're your hosts. And as I hope you could tell from the little intro, this is going to be about ghosts. We've talked ghosts before. It was more in a true crimey mystery sort of way back in an early episode. But in this one, we're talking about some well-documented ghost sightings, specifically some really OG ghost sightings from way back in the day. One that's here in America and one that's from England. And spoiler, there's probably, maybe, likely some hoaxing going on.
What?
What? Can you believe? But both of these were really big deals at the time. People were very convinced at the time that what they were seeing and hearing was legit. And hell, you might still think there's something to them by the time we're done. We're going to let you make the call. But in terms of being widely heard about, I'd consider them to be lesser known nowadays, wouldn't you? Even though they were big deals when they happened.
Well, yeah. You know, a couple hundred years will kind of dampen the excitement.
Right. So before we get cranking, TIFF, would you like to know the state of ghost believers here in the old U.S. of A?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, well, from YouGov, which is an international research data and analytics group, so they kick out really robust surveys and data and such, the stats I'm about to tell you are from October of 2019, and those stats are that 45% of Americans believe in ghosts. 45.
Wow.
43% of those believe that ghosts can come back and haunt people and or places. 36% say they have felt the presence of a ghost. And 13% say they have communicated directly with a ghost or spirit of someone who has died. Now, this made me feel indescribable emotions. For those of you who don't know, I am a firm, hardcore skeptic. TIFF is more open-minded. I'm not at all. Well, I am. I take that back. Here's my deal. I'm going to go for the simplest answer every time. My knee jerk is not going to be when I don't immediately have an obvious answer on my hands. My knee jerk isn't to say, oh, well, then ghost. Oh, well, then demon. Oh, well, then monster. Oh, well, then God. Oh, well, then magic. Oh, you know, I want as much evidence and let's rule out the possible before we consider the seemingly impossible. So it made me feel things. But having said that, the unweighted sample size was roughly 1,300 people, so I'm not totally bummed out. I'd like that sample to be much larger before I, you know, have a visceral. So
they're claiming that 45% of Americans believe in ghosts based on 1,300 people.
1,300 people, exactly. Now, it was a decent study in terms of structure, and I'll link you guys to it in show notes. You can read the whole thing. So, yeah, no, is that representative of the 300 and some odd million people in the U.S.? No, no, no. On the other hand, out of a random 1,300 people, that half of them would believe in ghosts, that does take me aback a bit. I mean, to say it's representative of all Americans is flawed, but still, out of 1,300 people, that half of them, that is a little bit concerning for me. For me. And now that I've turned off, now that like half of the people who were trying to listen have now turned it off, don't turn it off. I have a great story for you. So does Tiff. And we're going to jump right into it because we don't like a lot of blah, blah, blah. We know that most of you don't give a shit about how our day went and what we ate and what we're drinking and how our kids are doing and what the dogs are up to. So we like to get right to the stories. So, hey, if you're into that, buckle up. Here we go.
I have a very boring and rarely updated Twitter where you can find out that information.
Thank you. Exactly. Exactly. Oh, but listen, hey, speaking of Twitter, once the episode's over, you're going to hear an outro. That's where you're going to find out all the scoop on where we are social media wise and email address and all that good stuff, how to get in contact with us. And we love hearing from you. So, yay. And I think I go first, right?
Yeah. Get us started.
So you get to kick back and eat and drink and do whatever that we're not going to discuss while I talk.
Sounds good. All right.
Excellent. To the stories. All right. What I'm telling y'all today is what folklorist and author Robert Ellis Cahill called, quote, the first recorded and documented ghost story in American history. And to set it up, I'll open with a quote from said documentation. Pause, reader. And consider a few moments what evidence would convince you of the evidence of a specter. So while I'll definitely give my opinion later, this is definitely one of those stories where, you know, like I say, you got to make the call. I'm going to present to you what was presented to me, and you can kind of make your decision as you go. And that's for you too, Tiff, because I'm going to ask you what your opinion is as I reveal things.
Okay. All right.
I take you to 1799, United States, Maine, to a coastal town called Sullivan, where the aforementioned ghost has been creeping in a cellar, and I think you'll find this is a very unusual ghost. Now, to give you some atmosphere, this is about 15 years after the American Revolution, and technically, America was pretty damn small. The territories only covered a chunk of the eastern side, a touch of the beginnings of the northwest, and then most of the southeast. But the more you went out west, plus Florida, that was still Spanish territory. And there was a minor war going on. It ultimately went from July 1798 through September 1800, but it was called the Quasi-War because war was never officially declared. Okay. And it took place at sea. So this was a naval situation. To give you the most basic of basics, the U.S. was going at it with France because the U.S. stopped paying on a debt they owed from what France did for them in the Revolution, because the stance was that because France had abolished their monarchy in the time since, that the debt was to a prior regime, so that they should just forget about it. So I say all that to say, some minor drama going on at the time, but not a whole lot, and I bring that up to relate it to, Lord help us, here we go again, spiritualism. About this time, in terms of the supernatural paranormal stuff, spiritualism has yet to spring up. And y'all, you're just gonna have to listen to past episodes for the spiritualism stuff. I've just not got the strength. But just know this, that movement was all about communicating with the great beyond. Not to say that people didn't believe in the great beyond at this time. I'm just saying that it wasn't commonplace to be like, let's call up a medium and light some candles and hold hands and talk to the dead, see what they're up to. But the communing with the dead thing tends to trend with drama, particularly wars when there's lots of casualties and people feel helpless and want answers. Like I say, as we've discussed in other episodes, My point is, while there may have been casualties, and I'm sure there were, this was nothing comparable to what they'd just gone through in the Revolution, nor what they would go through later in the 19th century with the Civil War. People right now were just going about their everyday ordinary lives. Having said that, some historians and folklorists credit the events I'm about to share with being the actual catalyst for spiritualism in the United States rather than with the, quote, conventional starting point, which was to do with the Fox sisters' claims, which happened in the mid-1800s, and I'm sure we'll do an episode on them in the future. Won't go into that here. But about this, it, quote, prepared the ground in this country for the acceptance and spread of spiritualist rappings and allied phenomena, and, quote, several details that are now conventional features of the seance probably made their debut on the American scene with this case. Where we, and my other sources, are getting all the scoop from is from one primary source, which was a book published in 1827, and I will say it's a thorough one. It is filled with tons of testimonials. I saw noted 27, I saw noted 31. I confess I did not count in the book itself because my eyes were crossing. It is a tough read. And it's online in its entirety, so you can read the whole thing if you get a wild hair. And it's by this dude called Abraham Cummings. He says about the interviews, quote, with all these witnesses, I am intimately acquainted. I took these testimonies from their lips, for the most part, separately. I wrote them, read them in their hearing, and obtained their approbation of what I had written. Okay, so good. Seems like he did his due diligence there. Regarding Cummings, I could not find anything really on him, just that he's called Reverend in some places, and a theologian, and a traveling evangelist. What is he preaching? I don't know. I couldn't find anything that noted what his particular shtick was, what his denomination was, anything like that. But according to one of my sources, quote, much of coastal Maine in the years following the American Revolution were largely congregational, guided by Harvard-educated ministers trained in Puritan theocracy. And Congregationalists are Protestants, and because of time, we're not going to go into what that entails. Do you some Googling. His book has a huge long title. You shall see it in show notes, along with the link to where you can read it. And, you know, again, go do that should you feel the need to punish yourself like I did. But the main part of the title is Immortality Proved. And that's how the book opens up. The intro page reading, quote, immortality proved by phenomena that were witnessed by hundreds in the town of Sullivan, Maine in the year 1800. Published by an eyewitness, Abraham Cummings, a man eminent in learning and piety, a graduate of Harvard University. So because he graduated from Harvard and a bunch of people said they saw something means it's heavy air quotes proof. And I'm sorry, I'm such a skeptical bitch. I will say that in the opening paragraph, he does say, sure, we may be that what never exists can never really appear. However, I may be deluded by my own imagination or the artifice of others. So, okay, he admits that there may be bias and that's good. I'm going to give him props. But despite this, and despite it being noted that he was initially skeptical about everything, there was something that finally convinced him, and we'll get to that at the end. All right, we're in Sullivan, Maine, and I'll stop to note real fast, if you look into this story and see or hear that it happened in Machiasport, or possibly Machiasport, not sure how to pronounce that, it's a town about 50 miles up the coast from Sullivan. That is incorrect, as confirmed by the 2010 book, The Nellie Butler Hauntings, A Documentary History, which was an invaluable resource for me. Anyway, here's what went down. The Blaisdell family lived in Sullivan near Taunton Bay. The family included Abner, the father, who was a vet of the Revolutionary War, and he also happened to be very religious. There's 7 children total. I don't know who all was living at home at the time, but 3 are noted. Daughter Hannah, son Paul, and the 15-year-old Lydia. And the 3 of them I mention in particular because they come up throughout this story. There's conflicting dates mentioned, but we're going with my primary sources, the work done by historian Marcus Labrizi. It's wintertime, late 1799, and if you don't know, winter in New England, particularly Maine, because it's so far north, can just get horrible. Plus, these people live on the bay, so I just can't imagine. I'm getting cold right now just thinking about the wind chill coming off the water alone. So the family's all holed up in the house, and Abner hears knocking. He listens closely, and he figures out that it's coming from the cellar, so he goes down, and nothing. Quote, though irritating and distracting, the sounds didn't interfere with the family's day-to-day lives. Still, they were persistent, continuing intermittently for the rest of the year. Then, with the beginning of the new year, things escalated. And here's how. So, in late December, Abner and Lydia had started hearing something new, which is what sounded like a voice, but they couldn't understand what it was saying. Now, previously with the knocks, Abner, who, like I say, was very religious, he had gathered the family together and they had prayed that, quote, if there was deception, that the Lord would make it known to them, and that if the cause was of God, they might be preserved. And I'm not sure if this means that they wanted themselves to be preserved, but I think it means that's them saying they're cool with God knocking and, hey, keep it up. If it's God, keep it up. And then comes that voice. As some time passes, the voice gets clear and it says it's the spirit of Nellie Butler. Not a ton is known about Nellie, but here's what scoop we do know. She was a local, born on April 25th, 1776 in Franklin, Maine, which is a village near Sullivan, as Eleanor Hooper. So Nellie's her nickname. Her parents are David and Joanna Hooper, and she's one of nine children. When she was around 19, she married George Butler, who was a sea captain and a member of a prominent rich family of the area. Then on June 13th, 1797, she dies in childbirth, as does the infant. There's actually more documentation that I found in a different source about this, and we'll come back to that. But just know, they bury her in an unmarked grave. I don't know why, but they do, up on Butler. I know. That it doesn't make sense to me. Like, slap it. You're rich. Why can't you do a marker? I don't understand. But they do. And it's up on Butler's Point, because like I say, the Butlers, they're pretty rich. They've got shit named after them. And that's that, until she shows up in spirit form at the Blaisdells. Nellie says she's there to help facilitate the marriage of her widower, George, with the daughter, Lydia.
Okay.
This is not terribly out of the blue. Apparently, George and Lydia had been spending time together, but I don't get the impression it was a full-blown courtship, at least from Lydia's perspective, and we'll get to that. What it sounds like to me was that George was laying some groundwork, that's what he wanted, was to go out with her. Here's the thing. There was a major age difference. George was 29 and Lydia was 15. According to my sources, while it wasn't unheard of for girls to get married this young, quote, it was customary for women in the region at this time to marry at 18 or 19 years of age. George's father didn't like that he was putting the moves on this girl. And then Abner big time didn't like it because, I mean, it's his daughter. And he wasn't shy about saying it from the get-go when they first started hanging out. I mean, he knows what this dude George is up to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it said that Abner, quote, maintained a notorious and inflexible opposition to this connection, which had continued for several years. So, okay, everybody, let's be clear on that. Apparently, George had been putting the moves on Lydia since she was maybe like 13 or something.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. So Nellie goes, my dad, David Hooper, he lives about 6 miles from here, and I want both him and George to come and visit me. One place says that they sent for David Hooper, but it sounds like they physically went to the houses of the Butlers and the Hoopers in another source, because it talks about how on New Year's Day, when it was really storming out, and they went to the Butlers, and that, quote, George was not available just then. Okay. And then they go to the Hoopers and explain that his daughter wanted to talk to him. And he was like, get the hell out of here. You're nuts. So they head back home. Quote, by all accounts, David Hooper was a crusty old coot, not one to be easily convinced of his daughter's postmortem shenanigans. I love that. I love that quote. However, after they're gone, he gets to thinking about it. And Abner is a respected person in the community, hadn't been known to be all nutty like this before, and Hooper didn't want to be a dick, even though he thought this was stupid. Plus, he figured something must be going on, otherwise they wouldn't have come all that way in the storm, and then expect that he'd go out in the storm if this wasn't something really important to them. So Hooper bundles up, and he goes to their house. Now, I'm not clear on when Nellie Ghost was actually seen for the first time. One place says that the voice would just, quote, dart around the cellar at will. But then another says that Abner and Lydia claimed that the, quote, glowing apparition came with them and would be skimming over the frozen shoreline as they walked when they went to go get Hooper and Butler. And then one place said that when they got back, quote, Nellie appeared visually for the first time to Abner's son, Paul. Terrified, he ran home, reporting that he was walking through the fields and was chased by the apparition that floated behind him. That night, Nellie scolded Paul for not speaking to her when he saw her. So, I don't know the exact time frame, but the point is we've gone from disembodied voice to some sort of form. So, Hooper gets to the house, and Abner again is like, no idea why she's here, my dude, but she's been hanging out for like 6 months, and she wants to see you. Come on down to the cellar. And While Nellie doesn't show herself to her father, Hooper apparently hears her clear as a bell. And he is asking her questions that, quote, no one but his daughter could answer, and the voice always responded correctly. He is described as shaken, and that he later wrote, I believe it was her voice. She gave such clear and irresistible tokens of her being the spirit of my daughter as gave me no less satisfaction than admiration and delight. So Hooper's in. He's on the Nellie haunting train. And boy, did the train take off. By February, everybody and their mother had heard about old Nellie. Quote, tales of the strange specters spread to distant ports. The talk about the spirit became general in this and the surrounding towns and all over the county, and people came from long distances to witness its manifestations. Oh, yes. Yes, they did. It turned into a circus. I'll give you a rundown on that. But first, let me tell you about Nellie's whole gimmick. First thing to know is that she was super chatty, and she was like, bring it on. Invite whoever you want over. Bring them on down here to the cellar. And someone asked her at one point, well, why the cellar? And she was like, oh, I don't want to, you know, go upstairs and frighten the children. They're frightened, Nellie. They're frightened. Oh my gosh, I assure you. Second thing, but how kind, right? Yeah. She's so kind and welcoming.
She's,
come on down.
She's trying. She's trying her best. Okay.
Okay. Second thing to know is that she is just hell bent on getting Lydia and George together. It is all she's focused on. It's what she keeps coming back to, saying, quote, the parties must and would be joined, and what God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. So because she's invoking God, Abner is, of course, totally on board. And he's not against George courting Lydia anymore. And Lydia's like,
Hi, I'm 15. Let me just, no. Okay, sorry.
I'd like to be a child. I'd like to finish my childhood. Yeah, we're going to come back to that. And so Nellie would talk religious stuff a lot in general, too. So it sounds like for the most part, she was not only talking with and appearing to the Blaisdells and the people close to her, which I assume George was one of these people. But interestingly, he isn't mentioned as visiting until the fall. He's also not one of the people in Abraham Cummings' interviews, as far as I could see. Entirely possible I missed it, but I don't think I did because I'll get to it. In any event, as time passed, the crowds grew, and she knew stuff about the townspeople who were coming to visit, so she was apparently pretty convincing across the board. What did she sound like? Witness John Simpson said, the sound of her voice was sometimes hoarse and faint, but for the most part it was clear and free from impediment, and it was the most delightful that ever I heard in my life. Okay, bud. Another person said that her voice was, quote, shrill, but mild and pleasant. How can it be shrill and pleasant, I ask. That sounds horrible. It was also said that sometimes the voice sounded far away. Sometimes it sounded like she was right in front of you. And her main jam got to be basically preaching and singing hymns. Again, all that stuff is still interspersed with hammering home that George and Lydia should hook up. And here's what she looked like. Everybody concurs that she's always in white and that she, quote, radiated with light. One witness saying, the glow of the apparition had a constant tremulous motion. She was usually in a long flowy dress, but, quote, at least once she appeared in a shroud, at which time she was holding up the form of her dead child. Nice.
Ooh, okay.
There was an appearance noted in May 1800 when she shows up for about 20 people in the cellar, and witness Jeremiah Bunker says, at first, the apparition was a mere mass of light, then it grew into a personal form about as tall as myself. At last, the personal form became shapeless, expanded in every way, and then vanished in a moment. Abner had said that it moved like a cloud without ambulatory motion. Now, it does some ambulating later, which that's walking around, by the way, is what ambulating means for those who don't know. So basically what they're saying is that in these long flowy dresses and shrouds that it seems to be floating. I'm going to tell you some more about what witnesses attested to, but we need to have a timeout and check in on Miss Lydia. I am not convinced that Lydia was into George, and I'll tell you why. Now that everybody was talking about it and being amazed that this spirit, and not just any spirit, but the spirit of his dead wife, was insisting that it just be the most perfect union ever, and that they essentially had her blessing, quote, a tempestuous courtship then followed for Lydia Blaisdell and George Butler. I find that a very interesting turn of phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And Lydia's reaction was not simply to be like, hey, Dad, I really don't want to marry this dude. Like we said, you know, I'd like to finish my childhood. According to friends, and she told George this too, but according to friends, Lydia was going to hop a ship to go to York, Maine to stay with family there. And like I say, she tells this to George too. And he was like, nah, baby, we're meant to be. I'm sure, you know, and other garbage. But I mean, she was determined. She made plans, everything. Like she was going to do it. But Nellie somehow knew about this plan and told Lydia that, quote, her efforts were in vain. And that if she sailed away, her afflictions would sail with her. And this was in front of several witnesses. Yeah, basically a threat. Apparently, just tired and worn down, Lydia agrees to marry him. And on the night of May 28th, so really fast courtship, George and Lydia are married up at Butler's Point. I'd like to remind you that Butler's Point is where his, you know, dead wife, Nellie, is buried. Okay. Just, you know, it's a
very romantic place.
It's very romantic. It's just an all-purpose kind of gathering point. There's picnics. There's, you know.
Mm-hmm. One-stop shop.
Sometimes they'll bring ponies and let the kids ride. Yeah, just, you know, it's hot dog vendor. Okay. The next day, Nellie appears and says to them that in the future, Lydia would bear a child and die soon after, telling George, be kind to your wife, for she will not be with you long. She will have but one child and then die. I mean, what?
Wow, that's terrible.
So Nellie went from being kind of entertaining to, you know, cunt face McGee. Like, I don't know what is happening. Okay. Then she disappears for 63 days. In the meantime, the skeptics start getting more vocal. There was a crew who, of course, were thinking that this was a work of Satan, or Stan, as we like to call him here at the show, that Stan had dispatched a demon to do what? Get these two married for some unknown purpose? Just to fuck around with the town? Like, I don't, whatever. They thought it was the devil. And quote, few other hauntings created such a storm of controversy, sparking accusations of witchcraft, demonism, and fraud. Now that last part, the fraud. Here was what another crew of folks were thinking. They suspected that Lydia was behind this whole thing, that she was trying to trick her super religious father into giving his permission for the marriage. You know, that girl who was ready to take off and leave her entire family and support system at 15 years old to go to a completely different place that she had to take a ship to get to because it's that far away.
Bluffing.
Oh, that was all, please, that she'd been pushing him off for, you know, what did they say? Several years, she'd been pushing him off and the whole town's like, eh. And she's like, eh. But no. This was all this very intelligent, apparently able to create wondrous illusions that would rival Harry Houdini or something. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, okay, sure, it's this kid. So a lot of people were shit-talking Lydia. To some degree, all the Blaisdells, even saying that the daughter Hannah might have been part of the sham since she'd had Lydia's back this whole time. One place called her, quote, her only confederate. But it was mostly targeting Lydia. Like I say, over 2 months pass, no Nellie. Then shit really kicks off in August of 1800. Nellie's back. Now she's in full-on preacher mode, and she is stepping up her game in regards of what she's wanting people to visually witness, and she's wanting to put an end to all the gossip about both her being sent by Stan and about Lydia being behind some big hoax. Her tone had most definitely changed. One time she says, some of you say that I'm not a spirit, others that I'm an evil spirit. The words which I've spoken to you have been perverted and turned to ridicule, but I shall see you all again and you will not laugh.
Oh,
well, hell, Nellie. Okay. So then on the night of the 8th, 30 some odd people were crowded in the cellar to see her and quote, they even formed ranks through which the ghost passed back and forth at least 5 or 6 times, finally stopping before her former husband, who put his hand through the apparition. And Captain George Butler was immersed in her radiance so that he appeared white and shining. Several nights later, on the 13th, there's about 48 people crammed into the cellar, and she's like, meet me outside. We're going to walk over to James Miller's because he's a big skeptic, and I want to say fuck off to his face. I mean, she didn't say that, but that's basically what the point was.
That's what's going on. Yeah.
That's exactly what's happening. But yeah, so they go outside and she walks with them for over a mile to this dude's house. Her other motive for the trip was to prove that Lydia wasn't behind it. that she was going to appear outside and walk with Lydia. But here's the deal. Quote, "At length, she told us that we must go up and she would walk with us behind with Mrs. Butler. But you must walk in order, two and two," said she, "singing a psalm, for God is a God of order." Some person asked when she would be ready. She said, "I will let you know." Cool. Cool, 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 cool. This just smacks of being legit. Every bit of this. Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm the skeptic. I told you guys. Okay. Per witness Hannah Gatcombe, quote, "I was now far forward and did not see the spirit. When we came to Captain Miller's, the spirit wrapped there," which, you know, Snoop or Biggie or Kanye. Yeah, it doesn't specify. "And Captain Miller with Captain Blaisdell," and by the way, this is the son Paul that they're talking about right now, not Abner. So this is Lydia's brother. So, okay, "him and some others went into the cellar and I heard them talk but could not understand what was said to them. Then word came to us that we must stand out in the field before the house, that she would appear before us and again walk with Mrs. Butler, that the people might be convinced that Mrs. Butler had told the truth in relating that she had walked with her before. Then we all stood before the house. Mrs. Butler put on a black cloak, and when she had walked a little distance from us, as before, directed by the spirit, I heard her groan bitterly, and soon after I saw the appearance of a woman in white walking with her, and we all went back in order to Mr. Blaisdell's. I then looked back and saw a person in white walking with Mrs. Butler. After we returned to the house, Mrs. Butler appeared very weary and exhausted." Now, Miller had been skeptical from the get-go, but he'd actually been out to the Blaisdell house prior, and here's what he said about that. "Late at night on August 7th, Abner had come to his place and asked that he come to his cellar so that he could be convinced. So fine, Miller does, and there's a handful of folks along with him that they stopped by their houses and invited them along, because this just could not be a singular person. There had to be multiple people at a time. Just remember that. It could, other than the Blaisdells. The Blaisdells could apparently see her one-on-one. Otherwise, no, you had to be in a group. Now, they're upstairs in the Blaisdell house. They pray. Then they immediately hear knocking from downstairs. And I didn't mention this earlier, but as I'm sure you can tell by now about how Nellie would give such specific directions for the walk, Abner also had specific directions, amongst which were that people couldn't just head on down. They had to wait until Nellie was ready. And like I just said, she'd let them know with knocking. And also that it had to be dark, but that Abner could have like a candle lit, like just one or two small candles lit. Anyway, they go down and Nellie talks with him a little bit, then says, "I must go."
Okay.
And that's it. Miller says that by the time all this was done, it was now daylight, and that the door to the outside, because the cellar had that entrance as well as the entrance from the house, it had an entrance to the outside, that it was then opened and he couldn't see anything suspicious now that the cellar was all lit up. He's invited to come back again on the 9th. And about this visit, he says, "I went to that house with many people, among whom I observed much disorderly behavior. The spirit spoke little, and I returned with a resolution to go no more to that house on such an errand." Then, regarding the night I just told you about when the parade of people arrives at his house and he and Paul Blaisdell and a few more people went down to his cellar, and, you know, the lady that was upstairs said she kind of heard some talking, but she couldn't understand it. Okay, so Miller says, yeah, that's right, that a ghost spoke to Paul, but that he couldn't understand what it was saying. And then he hears knocking, and then Nellie speaks clearly and goes, "I have come to let you know that I can speak in this cellar as well as in the other. Are you convinced?" He goes, "Sure." Then she starts giving her directions again. Like, he can't figure it out. He's not there. He's not there yet. He goes, okay, just because, and I don't blame him, because you got to think about it. This has escalated. This started with, he went with a handful of people on the 7th. Then on the 9th, he went with more people and it was chaotic. I do have more detail about that. Just hang on. Then now there is a parade of, it's like 40 something people have shown up at his house.
Yeah.
All believing in this ghost and demanding that he believes too. Do you know what? I would have said anything to get these people away from me and out of my house and off my property. And I'd have been like, okay, I'd have gone along with whatever. So anyway, that's the impression I get. He's like, sure, I'm convinced.
Hey all, this is Cindy from Dummy World. Together with my co-host Kelly, we examine the underbelly of society. From true crime to urban legends to cults and beyond, Dummy World supplies your weekly fix of the dark side of life. New episodes air Monday. Find Dummy World where your favorite podcasts live.
So then she starts giving her directions again that everybody has to line up in the house and then proceed outside and watch as the figure comes into view. And then you know the rest, that she and Lydia walk together at the back of the group. So apparently there's one skeptic down and there's more to go. And here's another one that Nellie won over this August, a Mrs. Sally Wentworth, who just happened to be Nellie's sister. Back in January, the Hoopers, Nellie's family, were amongst the first Abner Blaisdell went to, like I'd said. And then Sally says that on January 2nd, quote, Hannah Blaisdell came and informed me that the extraordinary voice, which I had heard, had declared itself to be that of my sister and that I must go to her father's house. I replied to her face that I did not believe it. I love her.
Right up in her face. Mm-hmm.
The next day, I received the same message from three other persons of other families to whom I returned the same answer. Sally, I love you more. Nevertheless, I was at last persuaded and accompanied Captain Butler and my husband to Mr. Blaisdell's house. Captain Butler and I examined the cellar with a candle. I held Lydia by the arm when we heard a loud knocking and the sound of a voice which brought fresh to my mind my sister's voice. This voice spoke several sentences which were such as my sister used to utter, and from this time I cleared Lydia of the voice and accused the devil. Sally, I was with you, girl. I was with you up until right there. So close. So she was a skeptic, but not one of the this is a hoax camp. She was in the oh, this is the devil camp. Back to August, she says she was, quote, there again with about 30 others and heard much conversation. The voice was still hoarse and thick, like that of my sister on her deathbed, but more hollow. And then on the 14th, she goes down to the Blaisdell cellar again and, quote, I heard the same voice in the same place and did then believe it was my sister. I heard a private conversation which I had with my sister in her lifetime and which I had never repeated to anyone. We were alone together. But may it not have been overheard by some evil spirit who now personates my sister? I know of no such reason for her coming. And yeah, you know, that's right, Sally. Nobody can figure it out. And Nellie's been asked, but she's never given a solid answer. Why the hell has she shown up at the Blaisdells instead of at, you know, her home that she lived in with George? Or at the house where she was born and grew up at the Hoopers? Can't get an answer on this. Never do. And we never do. Well, I have an answer, but I'm in their terms of wanting the spirit to reveal the reasons, we never know. There's more. There's so much more. We would be here literally for hours upon hours if I went through all the nuances of the testimonials, but the point is that they're all really similar. We'll touch on some more bits that people said when we get to the what the fuck happened part of my segment, but this stuff in mid-August was pretty much Nellie's grand finale, as it were. But she'd given one last instruction. She wanted her baby dug up and reburied by her so that, quote, the child would rise at her right hand on the last day, meaning, you know, when Jesus comes, the rapture, whatever you want to call it. Why the baby wasn't buried next to her or, heck, with her in the first place is beyond me. Just like it's beyond me why her rich husband's family couldn't pony up for a damn headstone for her grave. Like, it's just weird. There's more weird concerning them, as I promised, I'd tell you. Just hang on. Anyway, about 80 people attended the digging up, which it's estimated this took place a little more into the autumn. Don't know how they know that, but that's what my sources say. And in his book, Cummings basically says, yeah, I don't get it. There was zero need to do this. Everybody's just obeying this ghost. That's literally the only reason for digging up a baby corpse. But speaking of babies, Lydia. And I don't know who knew this or if anybody knew this. I feel like it would have been mentioned. And if it was, I completely missed it. But Lydia was pregnant. And in the March of next year, 1801, Lydia Blaisdell Butler dies in childbirth and the infant was stillborn.
Oh,
Nellie had called it. And for people on the edge of skepticism, a lot of them were like, holy fuck noodles. And it pushed them either into believing or further into thinking this was Stan's doing. There's some weirdness that happens after her death, too. Kind of goes with the weirdness that I promised to tell you regarding Nellie's death. Still keep a pin in that. But first, we need to recap a touch so that you guys and Tiff can make your calls. To put it plainly, as one of my sources did, quote, the ghost simply did not act like a ghost. It goes on to discuss how ghosts don't typically have this repertoire of like singing and preaching and moving around and saying, hey, you can touch me and let me tell you some personal stuff. And just not so hell-bent on making people believe they're on the up and up and being so damn talkative, saying that the Nellie Butler ghost, quote, exhibited all the mental and emotional characteristics of a living human being. And I have to cut in here and say, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, and also, you know, that if you hear hoofs clomping behind you, assume it's a horse and not a zebra. Just all those fun sayings. That's okay.
All right.
It was also bizarre that she'd be setting up appointments for people to come over and that she'd be the one dictating all these rules around coming to see her. And all this stuff, as author Marcus Labrizzi puts it, quote, due to its unconventional behavior, the Nellie Butler apparition was, from the very beginning, open to speculations of fraud. Yeah. Sometimes when she was asked, you know, why didn't you appear when we had so-and-so over or when such-and-such group was here? And she'd say things like, I was not permitted to come where there was so much sin. So early on, she wasn't seeming to be really focused on convincing people. It's like she thought she had it in the bag. Then, as covered, when she came back after the skepticism towards Lydia and the Blaisdells was really kicking up, that was her sole focus. Let's talk about the crew that were the pure skeptics. So not the demon theory people. I mean, the ones who thought this whole thing was a sham. By the way, not much talk about George being the scammer. Having said that, though, the obvious first thing to be skeptical about was, as we talked about, why the Blaisdell house? So that immediately does cast suspicion on them, admittedly. We have record of Lydia being present at times, of Paul being present at times, and of Hannah being present at times, but to my knowledge, not all together at once. Not to mention there were more members of that family, but it seems like Abner was the only constant, the one who was running the show, as it were. There's also the thing about the cellar being dark except for a candle or two, and quote, given the poor lighting and the size and contents of the Blaisdell cellar, it was certainly possible for someone to be hiding there. I briefly mentioned it, but just to remind you, there were two ways into the cellar, one from the house, and there was a door leading outside, and there was also a window, which was described as unglazed and with a wooden covering, so no glass. Now, remember how the skeptic Miller had said that on August 9th, there was a lot of disorder, and so he cut out? Here's what happened. A dude had snuck into the cellar via that window and, quote, tried to impersonate the specter. So I don't know if that means knocking or speaking or if he was wearing a long white dress. I don't know. But they caught him, and they kick him out. Also that night, while everybody was standing around waiting on Nellie, several people started doing little knocks and, quote, turned the affair into a spree. So, yeah, if I'm Miller, I'm also rolling my eyes and leaving. But the Blaisdells apparently let people search the cellar as long as it wasn't Nellie time, of course. So here was Nellie's main stipulation. And I saved some detail for now so that you can kind of add it to or perhaps adjust the mental pro and con ghost list you've got going in your head. So Abner would say, we can't go down until she knocks to let us know it's cool. Already mentioned that. But if she wasn't already materialized, Nellie would just talk to them at first. And then, quote, she would typically order them out so that they might come down in order to see her phantasmal form. She didn't always do that. There were 8 documented times where she just sort of poofed in from the shadows. So, okay, she, I don't know, apparently had her hair and makeup done ahead of time on those instances. I don't know her. I don't know her life or her afterlife, whatever. Anyway, further, talking about the lighting situation, I was kind of tricksy with you. I know I made it sound like the candle or two were lit while Nellie was talking and visiting, and I have misled you. Quote, accounts concur that Abner Blaisdell habitually blew out the candle once everyone had assembled in the cellar, and pitch black darkness reigned until the appearance of the luminous wraith. I also didn't mention that while everyone agreed that, yeah, sure, that looks like Nellie, that sometimes the wrap she wore would kind of wind around her head, and that other times Nellie wore a hat.
She wore a hat. Okay.
That's what I said, I swear. But to be fair, some counterpoints. The sources, including Cummings in his book, talk about how it would be really difficult to pull off something like this. Like a human being there, is what they're saying, dressed up with all those people in the room. I would counter that point with depends on the size of the group, depends on a couple factors. So maybe to a degree. Okay, we'll come back to this. Another counterpoint made is how the voice seemed to come from different areas of the cellar and at different volumes, which, fine, but counterpoint. I don't think that'd be a particularly difficult thing to do in a very echoey cellar, but fine, whatever. A final counterpoint is the kind of filmy, glowy thing that it would have going on, the times where there's just no way it could be a human being, how it would kind of fade in and change shape and then disappear, all that good stuff. On the other hand, they did have tech at the time for a projector, and I did not know that. I knew about, what is it called, camera obscuras?
Mm-hmm.
Right, I knew about those, but I didn't know that they could pull off actual projector stuff. For some reason, it just didn't dawn on me, but they could. And it was nicknamed the Magic Lantern, and I'll put a picture of it in show notes for you. So it's basically a box with a hole in the front that has a lens, and then you have an image inside it, and then you have a light source at the back. And that's it. It can be as big or as small as you want it to be.
Neat.
Now, how do you make the images move? Quote, some suggestion of movement could be achieved by alternating between pictures of different phases of emotion, but most Magic Lantern animations use two glass slides projected together, one with the stationary part of the picture and the other with the part that could be set in motion by a hand or a simple mechanism. 'Twas not rocket science is the point, and certainly someone with means, I wonder who I'm talking about, might could procure one fairly easily, I would think. But Nash, wouldn't people be able to tell, you ask? Not necessarily. When I tell you my theory, I will tell you why. The outside appearance, walking with them, I have a theory on that too, which, you know, I'll tell you now. I think in that incident, it was an actual person, and they were so deep in the throes of believing by that point, and it kept so far back away from the group. And, you know, had them be, you know, they had to go inside that guy's house. They had to go inside Miller's house and wait. And then it took a while for her to talk to Miller in the cellar. And then she ordered, okay, and now have them go outside and wait. And then she said, and have Lydia come over to this side over here and y'all both be over there in the field. And then she comes back from around, you know, the side of the house where she's been talking through a window or whatever, through the Miller cellar. That's my theory on that. Okay. So now here's another part I left out earlier so that I could spring it on you now. Sometimes not everyone who is present in the cellar could actually see Nellie. Quote, the specter promised to be visible only to those who chose to see it. Accordingly, the ghost was invisible to anyone who wished either secretly or publicly to avoid seeing it. One witness called Sarah Simpson said, quote, I was soon informed that the spirit was about to appear. I went in with the rest, but prayed that I might not see her. She had promised that none would see her but those who desired it. Accordingly, I did not see her, though I looked directly before me, where they said she was. And more on her voice, too, says Cummings, quote, some of them heard and understood plainly, but saw nothing. Others heard a voice, but no speaking. Others again saw a light, but no person. And the very same persons who had clearly seen and understood at a previous interview could now only see light and hear a sound. I find this to be an incredibly smart move on Nellie's part, by the way. This ghost is incredibly intelligent, y'all. Just covering all the bases. No, it's not. It's stupid. Because if it's a hoaxer, they're covering all the bases. If you're the ghost and you're wanting to prove beyond shadow of a doubt that you're real, you're going to be crystal clear. Because you've proven you can be crystal clear and clear as a bell visually every time. I mean, at many times, she's proven that she can be very clear visually and very clear audibly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're bent on people believing that you're real, you're going to do that every single time. You're not going to be all this wishy-washy stuff. The only reason for a wishy-washy is if, okay, you get where I'm going with that. So what do you think so far?
I mean, yeah, it's one of the kids. It's a couple of the kids.
Yeah.
But there was, like, in the beginning, some of that stuff, I was like, oh, that's pretty good. That's kind of weird.
Oh, it's good. I think it's a hoax. Here's my thoughts. I think it's a hoax. Whoever's doing it's good. This is up there. For this to be happening at the turn of the century, you know, so 18th, 19th century, this is damn near pristine what they've done. It is very, and it's, oh, God, let me tell you my theory. Okay. This is just a great story. I love this story. And I got to quit rambling. Okay. I think what the people experienced was due to a combo of things, and some of which were really lucky for the hoaxers. I listened to a couple of podcasts on this, and there's not many out there, but I listened to a couple after I did my research because I wanted to see if anybody said what I'm about to say, what my theory is, and nobody did with regards to the motivation of whoever was behind this. Because that's what I always, when I'm trying to figure out a mystery, I always try to look for what's the motivation, what's the purpose. So here, the spirit's motivation, the prime motivation was getting George and Lydia together. And so then you got to think, well, who benefits from that? And so I, of course, think it was George Butler, and I do think it was the Blaisdells as well. And what I think was the main impetus, that the parents actually did want her to marry him because bank baby, hello, rich dude. But it wasn't looked upon favorably because of her age. And plus, they had to convince Lydia, who wasn't into it at all. Now, like I said, the macking on Lydia had been going on for, in their words, several years. And I'm going to take that as meaning 2 to 3 years. Nellie died in the summer of 1797. And this shit started going down in 1799. So he waited approximately, I don't know, 5 minutes after Nellie's death to start grooming Lydia. And yes, I'm calling it grooming because gross.
Yeah.
But my thought is that because the community was all ick and George's dad was all ick, that Abner was all, ick, right, sure, yeah, stay away from Lydia, oh no.
That's an amazing impression,
Thank you. See, I should be in a cellar in a shroud and a hat, holding a dead baby.
and an unlit candle, yeah.
Yeah. I think George was shady as all get out, and I'll tell you why. Three things, the first of which was not, aside from the, his pedo action. Okay. Three things. The first of which was not talked about at all in the podcast I checked out. And it is very surprising to me. So that source I mentioned that kind of bullet pointed the crux of the info from the Cummings book, which I've also linked you to that in show notes. It was written in 1884. And the author had done additional research on a little something that Cummings kind of skimmed over. She says, quote, "It appears that after the decease of Mrs. Nellie Butler, strong suspicions were entertained of foul play, and a trial, attended with circumstances of much suspicion and many curious allegations, took place to ascertain the manner of her death. The specter herself, as the phrase went, made several communications to different parties on the subject, and the general impression which prevailed in the community was that the frequent apparition of this unresting spirit was attributable to the fact that her life was cut short by violence. As the immediate descendants of the three families involved in this dark scandal are still living and reside at the scene of the hauntings, we do not feel justified in entering into further details. The Reverend Abraham Cummings alludes but slightly to the trial, the decision of the grand jury, and the persecutions which attended the various members of the families connected with the entire transactions. One thing is certain, the lapse of over 70 years since the period of these strange occurrences has not been sufficient to erase the impression that Mrs. Nellie Butler was murdered, and that to this cause was attributable her pernicious visitations to the scene of her earthly wrongs." I mean, whoa, I would love to know more about that trial. Like, what does that mean? Much suspicion and many curious allegations. So they thought that George killed Nellie.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So thing of the second, he did something really strange after Lydia died. He gathers up all her clothes and other belongings and puts them in what sounds like a rowboat, lights it on fire, and pushes it out into the bay.
Okay. So he did like a weird Viking funeral kind of thing.
Possible answer for that is my third thing. Hang on that. But real quick, the burning boat happens to float by the Blaisdell house and they saw it and realized what it was. And it caused a real rift between them and the Butlers and kind of divided the town. But we don't have time to go into that. Doesn't matter. One of the sources said, he was likely just horrified at the fact that perhaps he and Lydia had been cursed by Nellie's ghost, and that's why he did it. And no, that's bullshit. What I think was the reason was this so he could once again, taking about 5 minutes to mourn, move on to the next chick, which brings me to my third thing, quote, "A short time later, George married his third wife, Mary Guggins, who lived to the ripe old age of 85. I, of course, went digging. Now, the Mary Guggins from Maine that married a George Butler that I found gives this info, that she married him in 1805 when she was about 24 years old. So, okay, he's not pedoing it up anymore.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Congrats, George. You managed to do it. And apparently she kept him at bay for a few years and that they had four kids and that she died when she was 81. That's what correlates with what's on her tombstone. So close enough. I'm satisfied with that. And yeah, you heard me right. She got a gravestone and so did George. Nice. Nice. Hmm. Find a grave notes that they probably aren't buried there, but are buried at Butler's Point with everybody else. But still, they get stones and Nellie didn't. And I looked up to see if any bothered to get Lydia one, but it doesn't seem so. The point is that I guess old Guggins here passed the test of being able to have a baby without it dying on the spot, so she got to live. I mean, I'm not saying that he murdered Nellie and Lydia, but I'm also not saying that he didn't maybe help them along. Because don't forget, Ghost Nellie's spot on prediction, almost a threat about Lydia's death.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost like, hey, bitch, you better get pregnant. And you better have that baby. And it better be all okay. Yeah, you better be tough. You better. Yeah, that's in retrospect, knowing that he was brought on trial or that there was an inquest held to investigate Nellie's death.
Mm-hmm.
And then thinking that he's behind this and that that was actually said to her, to me, that's a threat.
Yeah.
Like it's on her that she won't die in childbirth. It's friggin' colonial times. Like, every third person had a stillborn or, you know, I'm making that up. That's not an actual statistic, but you get my point.
But it was not safe. It was not safe to have children.
Yeah, it was very commonplace. There was, you know, maternal and infant mortality rate issues going on big time. So anyway, like now that we know that there was an inquest about him maybe having something to do with Nellie's death, to me, that smacks of a threat. And not so much a prediction by a ghost, and especially knowing me being pretty damn sure that he's behind this, that it looks like more of a threat to her. Like, you better have that baby, have him a baby, and you better survive, and you better do what your job as the little woman is supposed to be and not, you know, peace out, I guess, like Nellie did. I don't know. I don't know what that threat's about. And like I say, I'm not saying that he outright killed him. I'm also not saying that maybe he didn't help him along. And he's been worm food for a while, so he can't see me and he can suck it. And that's all I have to say about that. So yeah, I think he was behind this. And I think he talked Abner into the plan so that people would shut up about him banging a child. And what better way to do it than for his dead wife to say that he had her blessing and that it got away from them when all the kickbacks started happening against Lydia. So they had to bring the ghost back to settle all that. And here's something else I wonder. Remember how Nellie disappeared for a few months?
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking the kickback reached a fever pitch over that summer after they got married, but the doubts in Lydia had been there pretty much from the start. So I was thinking, why wouldn't they have nipped that in the bud sooner? And I wonder if maybe George, because he was a captain, if he wasn't sent off to duty to fight in that quasi-war that I told y'all about, which was still going on, so he was sent back home, and that's why Nellie reappears in August. Maybe Abner was too nervous to pull it off on his own, or was nervous that Nellie would have to answer questions that he didn't know the answers to. Because my theory is that whether it was the sister Hannah or the brother Paul, because we know that they were in on it because they participated in going and getting people and sometimes being present in the room and sometimes not. Again, Abner was the only constant, but I think George fed whoever it was info so that they could fool people. Most notably, Nellie's father, Mr. Hooper, and her sister, Sally. And then the rest of the time, he was being all, oh, my stars, this is stuff only my wife would know. And talking about that big final appearance where they're going to the skeptical dude's house and how it was said that Lydia was looking weary and exhausted. My gut tells me that George had to tell her the truth and that she had to play along for this leg of the hoax in order to get the townspeople off her back. Plus, she was pregnant and probably felt like shit having to walk for miles. I mean, I know that I would.
Yeah.
But what about the people, the witnesses? The first thing, of course, is that the eyewitness accounts were collected by Cummings later. And we've talked about how stellar eyewitness accounts typically are. Spoiler, not great. And then as time goes by, memories tend to warp. For some, not a lot. For some, a great deal. It just depends. Second part of this, I think, are the ones where George and the Blaisdells lucked out, and they are twofold. physical health reasons and psychological reasons. For some health reasons, for one, my favorite in yours for the initial leg of this is carbon monoxide toxicity. So it's winter, they've got a fire cranking in the chimney and or the flue, of which may be faulty. There's little ventilation in the cellar, plus all those people crammed in there at various times. And CO is slightly lighter than air, and it did have the rest of the house was spread out in, so perhaps that's why they weren't dog-ass sick, but it could have been enough to make them a little loopy and a little more susceptible to stuff. Also possible, and this one's a touch more of a stretch, but possible, is if the family had a furnace. One that sold poorly but was still popular for a time was Ben Franklin's 1742 invention of the Franklin stove, which used both coal and wood. And the problem with it was, which is why it ultimately tanked, is that it didn't have a good draft. And for it to work, the fire had to burn nearly constantly. So again, there's that CO buildup issue. Another thing has to do with toxic mold or fungi, which I don't mean to say that it had immediate effect on all these people. I'm saying that they had it in their homes as well, like that there was just more exposure. Because, I mean, these homes were located on the coast, lots of moisture, and it's the damn 1700s. So come on. In a 2015 study out of Clarkson University, it says, quote, there were observed similarities between paranormal experiences and the hallucinogenic effects of fungal spores, which may explain why ghost sightings often occur in older buildings with inadequate ventilation and poor air quality. So, you know, there's your physical stuff. Some ideas there. And so basically my point is, let's say they were loopy for whatever reason and it made them more susceptible. And then on top of that, what I'm about to tell you now, as far as what they saw, slightly hallucinating or no, I think that sometimes it was one of them actually dressed up in that barely lit cellar. And when they were walking, and then when she'd speak to them at other people's houses, and then other times, I think it was a magic lantern situation when she'd be all bright and cloudy and that they were seeing a form where there wasn't really one, kind of like, hey, don't you see the bunny in the clouds? So that type of thing, like you want to see it. And so you see it. And that explains that kind of whole, sometimes people saw a light, but not really a form, but then other people saw a form. And then sometimes people could hear and understand think they understood what was being said, but others were like, no, I just kind of hear a voice over there. Not really. You want it. If you want it, you're going to see it. So the ghost, in that sense, the ghost was right. That if you want to see it, you see me and hear me, you're going to see and hear me. But if you don't, you won't. Well, turns out. So psych-wise, a couple things. We have talked prior, I know for sure in episode one, maybe others, that when you're primed in religion in the first place, you're more likely to, when experiencing a seemingly unexplainable thing, to chuck it into the category of otherworldly or from God or from Satan. So there's that right there out of the gate. But I don't think it was a shared psychosis situation because nobody was acting wild or crazy. For me, this sounds more like the groupthink phenomenon, which Merriam-Webster defines as, quote, a pattern of thought characterized by self-deception, forced manufacture of consent, and conformity to group values and ethics, which fits this community to a T. It is delusional in a mild sense, and that there could be proof right in front of you. Like, hello, obviously it was a person walking and talking with Lydia back there at the back of the line when they're making that hike from that guy's house. Oh, but we're not allowed to walk with them or get close. I mean, if they were thinking logically and they weren't so entrenched, somebody would have turned around and started walking straight towards them. And I guarantee you that person in the dress would have started backing up and would have bolted. I guarantee you. But nobody did it because they're so entrenched in their own story time. And like, I think of today when people are like, oh, that's fake news. Well, is it? I mean, if we've got it on video with so-and-so saying exactly what the paper reported that they said, and you can hear his tone and his exact words and his body language, and you have the context, then no, it wasn't fake news. The newspaper reported it accurately and you can see it and hear it for yourself. But then there are those who will still be in denial because they're so invested in their own, this story that they and their community created. So those are my thoughts. And, you know, y'all feel free to agree or disagree. Write in, let us know what you think. But I do want to bring it back to conclude with Abraham Cummings, our witness interviewer, and someone who throughout most of his book is coming off as a skeptic. Oh, but wait, we got one more appearance by Ghost Nellie. The walk to the house and the demand about reburying her baby wasn't her last hurrah after all. It wasn't the last experience that somebody had with Nellie Butler. Cummings says that the last true sighting happened in July of 1806 in some fields out in Waukeog Neck, which is in the town of Sorrento, which is near Sullivan. And he didn't get this from interviewing a witness because he was the witness. Quote, accompanied by two friends, Cummings saw the apparition of Mrs. Butler. From Cummings' standpoint, this personal experience far surpassed the testimony of the many witnesses. The vision was described as being about 12 rods ahead of him. I have no idea what that means, and I didn't look it up. And that there was a group of white rocks, and that a few minutes later, one of the rocks had risen up and, quote, taken the shape of a globe light with a rosy tinge, and he went toward it, and he kept his eye on it for fear it might disappear. But he had not gone more than 5 paces when the glowing mass flashed right to where he was and resolved itself into the shape and dress of a woman, but small, the size of a child, then expanded to normal size. Now she appeared glorious with rays of light shining from her head all about, reaching to the ground. And it goes on to say that, quote, after examining all the possibilities of fraud, the author summed up his feelings, including the most important fact. He personally witnessed the apparition. He therefore concluded that fraud could not have been responsible for the phantasmic experiences. God damn it. You know what? This isn't exactly true because he didn't examine everything. And you know why? This little sighting here, it double time pisses me off. It doesn't only piss me off for what you think, which is obvious because he friggin' succumbed to a trick of the eye, sun bouncing off a rock on the coast. You know, that's what he saw. I can't imagine what else he could have seen. But that pisses me off that he succumbed to that and thought, oh, it was Nelly. Why do you think it's Nelly? It could be whatever. Why wouldn't it Jesus? Why wouldn't it some relative of yours? Why wouldn't it, you know what I'm saying? Why wouldn't it somebody from the future? Why wouldn't it, why was it her? Anyway, so he didn't examine everything because you want to know what he was doing cutting through those fields, what he was on his way to do? Well, he was on his way to confront dadgum George Butler. He was on his way to his house because he'd come to the conclusion that George, just like your friend Nash, me, that's me, has been saying, because George was the one behind it. Son of a bitch. So that's your story of America's first documented ghost, Nellie Butler, who all in all appeared on roughly 30 occasions to more than 100 people.
She was busy. Damn.
It was George. It was George and the Blaisdells. Damn it. Except for Lydia. It wasn't Lydia. I don't blame Lydia for any of this.
That poor girl.
She just wanted to be a kid, man.
She didn't want to get boned.
Nope.
By a creepy dude. Good for her. Ugh.
What a different story this would have been if she'd actually got on that boat and gone and stayed with her family that lived in another town.
Yeah. Wowza.
I'm dying to know more about that inquest that they did about Nellie's death, though. I would love to know more.
Yeah. That seems like that would be kind of an important thing.
And I've never heard it mentioned. I say never. I found two podcasts. I found three. I take that back. I found three because I listened to one since I wrote this script. I found another one. Nobody brings this up. And it really surprised me. I think that's very important. I think that goes to motive big time.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if he's still kind of trying to shake off the rumors about him being involved in Nellie's death. Having Nellie pop up and being like, hey, I'm fine, y'all.
Yeah. Things are good. We're chill.
Bring him to see me. I want to see George. George, honey, I want you to be happy. Why don't you go bang that 14-year-old? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's just, y'all feel free to write in. Let us know what you think. If you think I'm off base, if you think this was actually a ghost, if you think that, no, it wasn't George, that it was just the Blaisdells, if you think it actually was Lydia, that Lydia really did want to marry George. And so she managed to create optical illusions and throw her voice even when she was physically there with people and they were holding on to her and standing like right in her face. Because that's what several places said. They would hold on to her arms and they would get right. They would like crowd people around her and be right in her face to make sure that she wasn't talking or manipulating anything. So y'all feel free to think it was Lydia, but it wasn't Lydia. It weren't her. I do think she had to be involved at the very end, clearly.
Yeah.
But by that point, she was screwed. She was already married to this asshole and she was already knocked up. She was, right. She was screwed. She had no choice. She had no options but to go along with it. Anyway, that's my story. It's not Lydia. I'll consider any alternate theories except for that one. I will not accept that it was Lydia. That's my only thing. Keep listening for the outro. That's how you'll know how to contact us. And again, feel free to contact us with any suggestions or any of your creepy, weird family stories or local hometown or state or province or whatever. Anything you think would be interesting for us to cover, and we will certainly consider it. What else, Tiff? Anything?
I got nothing. I think that you've done well.
All right. Thank you much. And this is where the catchphrase goes.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at show notes, along with any supplemental things we think you might enjoy.
Visit us on our blog at youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com. You can also find us on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast and on Instagram at youtotallymadethatup. Feel free to contact us on those platforms, and you can also email us. That address is youtotallymadethatup@gmail.com.